So this is part two, which is the last part. And the handout you have is looks like the first one, except for it's the other end, where last week was about the beginning and the things leading up to the millennial kingdom. Well, this is the end of the kingdom, and we're actually going to talk about during and the end and the things that follow after the kingdom. So that's what the handouts are about today. So if it looks like the same, you put them together, you go, oh, I see, one's following the other. They're not referring to the same thing. They're talking about the beginning and the end of the millennial kingdom. So in this context, Revelation 20 is a key passage because it's where it talks about the, in seven verses, it mentions a thousand-year kingdom right off the bat. So you're challenged with the question, well, do I take it for what it says or do I spiritualize it? And if you spiritualize it, you can do most anything your imagination can come up with. So I'm pretty sure the guy wasn't trying to confuse us, but he's trying to inform us. So I take it very much literal. Take it to mean actually a thousand years intended. So we did. This is last week's, and so we briefly went through this. Some of the things that are going to happen in the order which they're going to occur. There's the end of the week, and we're going to break that down later in more detail. Again, we're still covering major themes. And next week, I think we're going to talk about the two witnesses and the 144,000 Jews. I think that's going to be interesting as well. And we're going to allude to them coming up next couple of weeks, let's put it that way, as well. So there's more detail to them because they're pretty important. But as it comes to related to the millennial kingdom, there's the end of the week, which Jesus came down at Armageddon, which was the sixth of the bowl, right? And then that they come in and you got the big battle. It's really not a battle, it's a campaign. They're building up like they're going to be a battle, and Jesus just stops it all and takes it all over. So it's not much of a battle. And then he goes into the seventh of the bowls, and you got a big earthquake, and Jerusalem's divided into three parts and things like that take place. So that's a big event takes place in Jerusalem. So the end of the week, and then you get all of the last of the plagues, the bowls, for 30 days. And the two witnesses are important because they go 3.5 days at the end of the week. They go to full 3.5 years plus 3.5 days was their bodies lying in the street. So they go a little bit into the 30-day period. Then the 45 days is really about judgments that are going to take place. Matthew 25, really quite a number of passages that deal with the different judgments. And Matthew 25 is probably the most popular one in the New Testament, dealing with how do you treat Israel is depending on your the level of judgment. So that's an important concept for us as well. So the big thing is the Battle of Armageddon, and then the judgment of the Gentiles, Matthew 25, and then the judgment on the unbelieving Jews. It's going to be the believing Jews and the unbelieving Jews, and we're going to focus on Israel, how they come to faith. And what's really important to that is the two witnesses and the 144,000 are very important as to how Israel, so that we get to the end, and it says in Romans 11:26, and all Israel shall be saved. Well, that's an interesting concept, but he means that all Israel, all Jews at the time that survived the judgments and all that will be saved. And so that's an important concept as well. We're talking about the actual order of those events. So going into the kingdom, which is what we're talking about today, the earth is going to go through some sort of renovation, because you're going to see the earth isn't going to be the same as it is now. Animals are not going to act the same way that they do now, like the wild animals that are carnivore, and they want to eat flesh. Well, they're not going to do that during this kingdom. That's one of the obvious changes. And so, a child can put their hand into a cobra's nest or a hole and not have any fear. It's a time where danger goes away. It's a time where you don't have these fears. Like right now, you're like, I might put my hand down there without a flashlight and checking out the hole, see what's down there before I put my hand in. Well, we're afraid of that now because we know we could get hurt. Well, that's not going to happen during that time. So there's going to be some kind of renovation, not a full change to the earth, like in your chart you have now. The earth will be completely remade, and we're going to talk about that, what that means. But this is a partial change, a partial removal of the curse. When Adam and Eve lived on the earth before sin, we believe it was the conditions similar to that. Like before Genesis 3, and they fell into sin. The condition before then were they didn't have any fear, nothing to be concerned with, and they didn't seem to understand death or anything like that. So bottom line is, I think they seem to understand some degree of it, but I don't think they experienced it. They seemed to know what death was, but they didn't experience it before, so it was a new concept back then. But that's another issue. So we think the conditions during the kingdom, during the earth, will be more like it was before the fall of man. And if you're thinking about it from the bigger perspective, why would there need to be a kingdom? It comes back to the same question everyone's asked all the time. When Adam and Eve fell, we say, well, they fell in the best of conditions, right? I mean, it's pretty great conditions. They didn't know what sin was. They had nothing to fear. Everything was awesome. They had one condition: don't eat of that tree. Okay, we don't eat of that tree. We don't know how long they lasted. But long story short is, they acted on their own, independent of God. In fact, there's a lot of details to that, but as far as the man and the woman and the roles that they took. But the bottom line is, they fell into sin. And so dispensationally speaking, is a big term, but dispensationally speaking, the millennial kingdom shows that when you set up the right conditions, when people know the truth and know what sin is and all this, you get the right conditions, guess what man will do? They're going to blow it again. I mean, so it's important that dispensationally you understand the millennial kingdom has a purpose of demonstrating we need God more than we know we need Him, or more do we ever acknowledge that we need Him. So that's what's going on here. So the chart you have today is dealing with the overview, not this one, but the overview of the kingdom during that time. So the millennial kingdom, a couple of points. We're going to introduce the idea of New Jerusalem, because New Jerusalem is a part of the timing of the millennial kingdom. The millennial kingdom is what? On the earth. Well, the New Jerusalem is where? Well, we're going to get there. It's not on the earth, but it seems to hover, it appears, above the earth. And so they're going on at the same time. On the earth, the kingdom. In the sky, the New Jerusalem. We're going to look at all the particulars that go along with that. So Christ will rule as king. Isaiah 9. In fact, the Isaiah 9:6 passage, a lot of people know that verse probably by heart, right? You probably quoted that verse before. Isaiah 9:6, for unto us a child is born, right? Unto us a son is given. And there's a semicolon there, which is where we live today. We live in that semicolon. I'm just quoting from Isaiah 9:6. And then he says, and the government will be upon his shoulder. Oh, so this is one of those great verses where it talks about his first coming, and then it breaks, and then it talks about his second coming, when he comes back to the earth and he will set up his kingdom. So unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, is referring to the first coming, and then the government would be upon his shoulder, is referring to his second. So this is one of the fun things about the Old Testament, a lot of the prophecies, of a lot of them, where it actually has this view of first coming and then second coming in the same verse. And you got to read it with that understanding, that sometimes it refers to Jesus all along, but sometimes referring to the first coming, sometimes to the second coming. He never set up a kingdom. He had no intention to set up a kingdom when he came the first time, but he certainly will and does intend to set up a kingdom when he comes back again the second time. And then it says, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Who's he referring to? Jesus. Tried to do that with a Jehovah's Witness, and they go, oh my goodness, I can't know, it can't be. No, it's Jesus he's referring to. Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, they're all one. When you misunderstand the Trinity, you misunderstand God in his nature. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David. So Jesus is going to rule as king, but he keeps mentioning in multiple places that David's involved. So he's going to be sitting on the throne of David as a descendant of David. So David's involved somehow. like we can be and will be involved as well. So let's just go on some of the other points. Nobles and governors will also rule. Isaiah 32 talks about he's going to have other people that are going to be ruling with Jesus. I'm just kind of running through this because there's a lot of, I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of verses that describe what's going to go on. And I try to pick some of the things that I think will be somewhat interesting. Matthew 20:19, Jesus talked about we will sit on thrones and we will judge Israel. That's one of the things that he's going to do with us. Some of the privileges that we have as believers is that we will rule with him. Jerusalem will be the political center of the world. Zechariah 8:13, I guess Zephaniah has some passages as well, and they all talk about how people will come every year to bring homage to Jesus, and they come to Jerusalem every year. That's what they're intended to do. So Jerusalem's going to be very important at that time, the political center of the world. And so God will fulfill his promises. Last week we talked about this sentence here. God will fulfill his promises to Israel, to the church, to the nations, to creation and his son. Remember, that was the outline of what we talked about last week. And all the different verses that were promises that God made. Is God going to keep his promise? I sure think so. Absolutely. And there's a lot of people that say, well, you know, not to Israel. He might have to some of the others, but in the church and creation. But not, they just have a thing about Israel. You can't, when you hate Israel, you just have to dismiss everything the Bible talks about, including the promises made to them as well. So this kingdom is about fulfillment of promises. Okay. And those in the kingdom, there's going to be two kinds of people in the kingdom. I guess you could say three, but it's two major types, right? Those who are in their mortal bodies, that would be like our bodies now, are immortal, right? Very mortal, physical beings. And those that are glorified. The one here will probably go into it in glorified body, depending on if we are raptured or if we die, we're going to have the resurrection body before the kingdom begins. Excuse me. Excuse me. And so the mortal bodies are those in their regular bodies, and starting out the kingdom, there will only be one kind of person in the kingdom: believers. I mean, there's not going to be any unbeliever in the kingdom as it starts out. And that's kind of the question, that's the key to understanding how things, how the kingdom, how it dispensationally matters, because ultimately, even though it starts out with all believers, it doesn't end that way, as you're going to see. It's going to be an awesome period of time, going to be a great period of time, it's going to be very wonderful in a lot of ways, but the point is, everyone's going to start out as believers in the kingdom. So, Jews will be brought back to the land, and again, that's a whole study by itself, and they're going to process the promised border, not the little borderline that they have now, but the full promise that they had made to them in Genesis and many passages. Even St. Kings talks about those same dimensions of the promise itself. They never had processed it. If God's promised it to them, we believe that he's going to fulfill that. So there's going to be Gentiles also in the kingdom. A lot of promises made to them. And they're going to be divided up into nations. Well, don't know all the extent of what that means. If you were part of Ukraine, are you going to be Ukrainian? I don't know. Maybe. It seems like it's a possibility. Because there's going to be some pretty big devastation. In fact, when you get to the last plague, number 7 of the bowls, it's a great earthquake. And again, Jerusalem is divided into 3. And then they got these hailstones of about 100 pounds apiece. Right? And the people are going to see all this, and they're going to be, wow, this is amazing stuff. And they're going to go, wow, we need to believe in Jesus. And the next verse doesn't say that. It says, and they blasphemed God because of the plagues he brought upon them. It's just incredible to see the nature of man in working. So there's going to be people in their mortal bodies, which means they can reproduce, and they will. That's where the new individuals come into play. They're either going to believe or they're not going to believe. And if they don't believe, now you have introduced those who are unbelievers into the kingdom. And that, of course, comes through the mortals. Those in the glorified bodies would be like us, or the Jews of old that have died in their resurrected body, and they're in the kingdom, and they're ruling and reigning with Christ. on the earth. Now again, that's on the earth, we're emphasizing that, because when we get to the New Jerusalem, there's that extra dimension going on at the same time. So let's go on. The better health conditions. Well, there's a lot of concepts there. So the effects of sin's curse will be greatly diminished, but they will still be subject to physical sickness. People will still die. People will still be sick. In fact, some people, a number of theologians, think that if you get sick, it's probably because of sin in your life. It's usually that kind of effect, because the conditions are pretty nice. People will live a long life, and so they think, well, if somebody gets sick, it must be because they have rejected Christ, or they, to such a degree that they got sick. Somehow that God brought a sickness upon them. So if you live to age about 100, that's expected to live at least 100, right? Isaiah 65, I think I have that here. Isaiah 65, yeah, verse 20. No more shall an infant from there live but a few days, but an old man who has not fulfilled his days, for the child shall die 100 years old. It'd be like you're like a child if you live to 100. You get the idea. They're going to probably live a lot longer than that. But the sinner, being 100-year-old, shall be accursed. So if somebody dies at, say, 100 years old, or he's an accursed person, he must be somebody who's done sin. And I think that probably makes the most sense as to, he's introducing a perfect condition where everybody starts out as believers, right? So you think that's pretty awesome. Everybody's a believer. Everybody believes in Jesus, and that's great. But as time goes on, you're going to find people who were born, they may or may not believe, and they are people that will get sick, and you think, well, why would in that condition, as perfect as it is, why would believers get sick? Doesn't seem like it would make sense. So anyway, so there seems to be the idea of sin, and if you have feigned obedience is a really good term. I think Bob Bollinger, a pastor friend of mine, used that thing. Talking about the kingdom, it's a feigned, meaning outwardly you're obedient, but inwardly you're a closet rebel. You're really a rebel inside. But outwardly, Jesus, we brought our homage, we're doing good. And he's grumbling inside, right? He's hating it. And there you're going to have those kind of people, which apparently by the time you get to the end of the kingdom, it's going to get more and more difficult. There are going to be more and more of that. Of course, that's when Satan is released at the end. So again, as a partial removal of the curse, the conditions will be better. You're talking about the animals, and Isaiah 9 is really an interesting text. Just read through that. It talks about all the different kind of changes that will take place during the millennial kingdom. So it's a real good one chapter you can go to get some good sense for what's going on there. And talking about, again, the animals that normally carnivorous would not be eating, the young lambs or the long goats or anything that they normally would eat, they won't eat it anymore. So they actually will be eating straw. Simply, the sickness will come as a result of sin, and I think that may be. There's an interesting proverb in Jeremiah 31, verse 30, which the New Covenant is Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34, right? So he's talking about how when Jesus comes and the kingdom begins, that's the whole idea of the New Covenant. He's going to write the law, he's going to write his law upon our hearts, right? It's in that context. It's kind of a proverb, Proverbs 31, but everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Then he says, any man who eats the sour grapes, his teeth shall be set on edge. The point that they're saying is, you're not going to be getting sick because of somebody else's sin. You're going to be getting sick for what you've done yourself, individually and personally. And that's the picture. This is a funny little proverb that's there in Proverbs 31 that gave us the idea, because there's a lot of people saying, oh, I'm having all these hard trouble because my father did this or that, and you're blaming somebody else. They're trying to blame. And no, he's actually making the point. No, bad things happen to you, probably because you're doing it. And that's actually the idea and the meaning of the text there in Jeremiah. So the conditions, the general conditions, time of unimaginable splendor invisible displays of God's power and majesty, meaning it's going to look awesome. Now, this picture here, the only reason I liked it, I don't know about the rainbow part, if there's a rainbow over it or not, but the idea, remember Jerusalem we talked about, is going to be raised up. That's the only part I was really showing. I think it's going to be much larger than what this shows, but it's raised up. It's going to be higher than it is now. Remember when Jesus comes down, and it's going to be the water coming out of it and all that, go to the Dead Sea and to the Mediterranean, but the whole earth is going to rise up, and Jerusalem is going to be a much higher place than it is even now. That's the reason I was wanting you to get that vision in your mind, what it's going to be like in Jerusalem, because you're going to see it someday. Is that awesome? It's going to be kind of cool. So, the time of happiness and joy, physical and emotional pain will be replaced by joy that comes from the personal presence of Christ. And there's so many, these texts are just awesome, talking about what it's going to be like in that time. It's going to be a wonderful time, and it's just going to be awesome. Let's just put it that way. And then the wealth of the world will pour into Jerusalem. Again, everyone's going to come to Jerusalem and to bring their wealth and all that goes with it. So, those are, I think, pretty obvious. I can go through all these verses, but I you can certainly do that on your own if you'd like to. So this is a chart you have in your hand, and this is the end, right? The things that renovated earth was at the beginning of it, where it changes some of the conditions of the millennial, and then but not all of them. Right, it's not going to be completely renewed. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. Later on talks about that, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But so what's going to happen is the earth is renovated, and it's going to be the curse removed to a degree, at least partially, and the conditions are really nice, and everybody's living in a happy life, and nobody's living in fear, and they're living long lives, and they see Jesus in person roaring from Jerusalem, right? And they see him in person and all that. And so there's going to go, but then you get to the end of the kingdom, and what's going to happen? Remember there in Revelation chapter 20, talks about that very thing, right? Verse 20. Revelation 20, starting verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, right, that old serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. He gives you all the names that you know of him, so you can't miss them, right, who he's talking about, and bound him for 1,000 years. And that happened before the kingdom began. Satan was bound for 1,000 years. Then he cast him, verse 3, into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal on him, so that he should cannot deceive the nations anymore. Right? So, till the 1,000 years were finished. Oh, till. It gives you an until. So he's saying he's not going to be the one deceiving the people. Right? Again, it's the old, you can't say the devil made me do it. No, you did it because you chose to do it. If you rebel, Satan's bound so that he can't deceive people, and there's going to be an ongoing rebellion, believe it or not, by the time you get to the end. Then verse 3, yeah, let me finish verse 3. So you're going to be set so that he should not deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Oh, there's a purpose for it. God has a purpose for it. He's demonstrating. He's going to reveal what's inside of people. Well, they're going to say, praise Jesus, right? But internally, you're like, I hate coming here every year. Who's he think he is? And whatever attitude that's going on inside of people's heart. Well, when Satan gets involved, they're no longer going to hide who they are. They're going to reveal who they are. They're going to demonstrate that they really don't love Jesus. They really don't want to worship him. They really don't care for him. And so Satan is going to be released from the pit, and it goes on from there. So, in fact, let's just continue, I think, and let me see where I was going to go with there, because I didn't want to, there's a lot of passages that matter. So then you get down to verse 11 of verse 20, chapter 20. It talks about there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth, but there's going to be the great white throne judgment. Before I get there, there's going to be a couple, there's the Gog and Magog thing is mentioned in verse 7 and 9. So let's go there. 7 and 9. Revelation. I should just read it right out of my Bible. Probably be better. Okay. Because he talks about there's going to be a resurrection there in chapter 20. That's important. So let me read verse 5. Let me just start back there. All right. Verse 4. And I saw thrones, And they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God. So what's going to happen here, there's going to be a resurrection that's going to take place, right? That's actually referring to before the kingdom begins. There's a resurrection at the end of the 70th week. And that resurrection is for believers that make it, either that died during the 70th week or who survived. I mean, they don't need to be, they're going to be glorified, apparently. Some of them will be. But If you're alive in the 70th week, you go into the kingdom. I shouldn't confuse that. So if you died during the 70th week, that is during that time of persecution and wrath for those that made it through that period, they're still going to be able to go into the kingdom if you believe. And only believers will go in. Verse 7, though, is where I want to get to, because he's Satan has been bound, right, at the beginning, and now we're at the end of the kingdom. And when 1,000 years have expired, verse 7, Satan will be released from his prison, right? He's been bound for what purpose? So that he will not be able to deceive the nations, right? Exactly. Verse 8, and he will go out to deceive the nations which are on the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. Again, this is where Gog and Magog is mentioned. It's after the kingdom. It's not an event that takes place beforehand. It's after the kingdom. They will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. Really? That many? It's going to be a lot of people that are going to rebel. So imagine if people are going into the kingdom, they're all believers, and they're healthy, and they live long lives, and they're not believing. You could have quite a number of people that are unbelievers in the millennial kingdom because they're living a long time. There's more and more babies being born. Some are going to believe, some are not. And some are not become the sand of the sea number. It's going to be a big number at the end. Satan is let loose. Now he's going to start deceiving the nations. He's just revealing what's already in their heart. If you're a believer, you're not going to be part of this, right? This rebellion. But if you're an unbeliever, you want everything to do with it because you want to be in control. I mean, not everybody thinks in those terms, but whatever your attitude is, you know you don't believe in Jesus. You don't want him as the ruler. Then he says this in verse 9, they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, right? And fire came down from God of heaven, from heaven, and devoured them. Well, that was fast. That was the whole battle. I mean, and so, but where did they go? They went to Jerusalem, they surrounded Jerusalem, right? And they think they're going to take it over. It's kind of like Armageddon. They all get this big campaign. 2 million people comes across the Euphrates. A huge army comes in, and who knows how many others. That's how many comes from the east. And they all converge in one place, Armageddon. And they get ready for a battle, and it goes, done. So it's a big campaign. It's a build-up. It's a big build-up. And it looks like it's going to be really big, and it ends up deflating, obviously, when Jesus just puts it all to a stop. And that's what goes on there. So, and then verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire, this time instead of the bottomless pit, which is where he was put at the beginning of the millennial kingdom, he's taken out of the bottomless pit, a special holding for him, and then he's cast into the lake of fire, which is the lake of fire is really ultimately what we call hell. Because death and hell are cast into the lake of fire. That's the thing that's eternal. So if we say hell, we really mean the lake of fire, because that's what lasts forever and ever. So it says, I'm going to read verse 9 again. They went up to the breadth of the earth, surrounded the camp of the saints, that'd be in the beloved city, Jerusalem, and fire came down from God out of heaven, devoured them. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire, and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet were. Remember, beast and false prophet were cast into the lake of fire. Now Satan is finally there as well. They all have the same doom, eternal judgment, right? And they would be tormented day and night forever and ever. And there's a number of people, quite a few denominations that actually said there's no such thing as hell. It's a judgment that doesn't. Eventually, they're taken out of existence. They're no longer conscious. They're no longer feeling judgment. They're no longer feeling torment. But the language is very clear. Jesus talks about that as well. In fact, Jesus talked about hell more than anybody, right? I mean, he's the one who described it and talked about the seriousness of it, where the worm dieth not, the fire never quenched, and the whole idea is it never stops. And that's exactly what he says here. And their torment will go up day and night forever and ever until it stops. No, it says forever and ever, and period, meaning there's no point in time that they cease to be in existence. And so there's a number of people who actually deny that there will be a hell. I can understand not wanting to think about it, because there's no hope. If you're in hell, there's no hope. Nothing. There's just nothing you can do. You can't say, I changed my mind, I believe now. No, it's too late. You had your opportunity and you didn't choose to believe. Okay, so New Jerusalem is a new concept, I think, that relates to the kingdom. Because while the kingdom is going on the earth, what's going on above the earth is a totally different thing altogether. And so this is something that came down from God out of heaven. Let me go down to New Jerusalem. So the first passage that comes to mind would be 2 Peter 3, because what we just referred to was that the earth is going to be changed, right? It's going to be this earth, is going to be not just a little renovation of the earth, it's going to be completely different. 2 Peter would be a great verse. You probably read this one, and what does that mean, and when is that going to take place? It says this, but the day of the Lord would come as a thief in the night. And what's he called that? The day of the Lord. So the day of the Lord is about judgment, but the day of the Lord also included the entire millennial kingdom, right? The entire 1,000 years. So there's some passages called the day of the Lord referred to the blessings of the kingdom. And so when Peter says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, he's giving a big overarching summary. Yes, the day of the Lord comes upon them, upon the unbeliever, as a thief in the night. But then he describes, like many of the other prophets described in the first event, like Jesus' first coming, and then he goes right into the second coming. Peter does the same thing here, 2 Peter 3:10. Says, in the which the heavens will pass away, right? Let me go back to there. And the heavens and earth will pass away with a great noise. The atoms and all that of the earth will melt with fervent heat. The earth and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So it's the idea that the whole earth is being completely renewed. This is after the kingdom, after Satan is cast into the lake of fire, ultimately and forever. And then there's the great white throne judgment, which is only for unbelievers. So everyone will be resurrected for that purpose, to go into this judgment. All unbelievers will go to the great white throne judgment. There is no, the decision's already made. If you're at the great white throne judgment, your eternal destiny is already set, that you already know where you're headed. He's going to demonstrate to you that you deserve it, and that's going to be a tough place for anyone to see. But this time of the new heaven and new earth will take place, and then we usually put after that, we say the eternal state, then it goes on into eternity. But I want to talk about some newer, different ideas again. So back there in Revelation 20, we were reading, and I skipped a couple of verses on purpose, verses 5, 6, and 7, right? But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection, okay? The first resurrection, again, referring to believers. Blessed and holy is he who's taken part in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Again, there's going to be a resurrection of all the believers that have died up to the point of the end of the 70th week of Daniel. They go into the kingdom. We will rule and reign with him. Right? And then he goes into verse 7 again, where Satan is let out. And of his prison, he goes out, deceives the nations, and then he's destroyed, right? Continue on, verse 10. I guess I did go through that part. So that's very good. So Satan is destroyed, and the new heaven and new earth will take place after the great white throne judgment. Now, could it be a reversal of the two? Yeah, but it seems like great white throne new heaven, new earth, eternal state seems to be logical. Some of it isn't like, okay, this is first, and this is second. Some of this is derived. You have to figure out logically. And I don't know whether you're pre-trib or pre-wrath. None of what we're saying here is confusing to either one. Pre-trib, pre-wrath, all we see the same thing here, this part of it. The only thing we're differing with them is the timing of the rapture and the details, especially in the 70th week. But here, all premillennialists, all pre-wrath would all say that that this is the events are exactly as we see it here, right? The same exact order. So New Jerusalem. I picked a couple of verses here that I think that are kind of interesting. So the idea of New Jerusalem isn't new. I mean, it's been talked about for a long time. I had a couple of verses in the New Testament, like Galatians 4. I got these references here. Galatians 4. For this Hagar. Now, referring to the Jews, Israel, as they came out of Egypt. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, where they received the law, right? And corresponds to Jerusalem, which is now. So there's some spiritual language going on here, analogies. He's using people of the Old Testament to represent things in the New Testament. But that isn't the main idea I want us to get here. And is in bondage with her children. But it says, but the Jerusalem above is free. So he's saying the Jerusalem down here isn't free because it's under the law. And the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. That's Paul speaking. It's kind of strange language. We read that and go, yeah, okay, what's the next verse? Because we don't always know what it means. But he's actually referring to the fact that there is going to be a new Jerusalem. And it's free and it's above us. It's something beyond, it's not in the normal realm like we think in the material world that we live in right now. Hebrews chapter 11, talking about Abraham. By faith, Hebrews 11 loves all talking about all those great heroes of the faith. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Then he says this, talking about Abraham. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So we think about Jerusalem, whose builder and maker is men who built rocks and things, you know, on earth. He's talking about a spiritual Jerusalem. The idea there, he's living for and look forward to something that's beyond this earth, right? It's something that's very spiritual. Same idea in Hebrews 13. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. And again, in all these contexts, it's comparing the earthly Jerusalem with some heavenly spiritual city, which we know to be the new Jerusalem. It's going to be the thing that comes down from God out of heaven. So those things are taking place, and they're living for something that's greater than the things on this earth. Does it mean that the things on this earth aren't going to happen? They're all going to take place. And the promises of the millennial kingdom are very important. They're all going to take place on the earth. But ultimately, it isn't about what we do on this earth. It's about what God has created for us in heaven is going to be the thing that matters the most. Then, Revelation 21 is interesting because this section, starting in verse 9 through 22:7, is kind of a debated text. And I don't think it's that difficult. I think it's easier to figure out. It's kind of like when we were talking about the marriage supper of the Lamb 2 weeks ago, right? And we concluded that, because he said the New Jerusalem is that comes down from God. We're going to read that text in a moment. That comes down from God, and he calls it the wife, right? He said it's the Lamb's wife. And so you're going, well, who's in there? And so why would he call a building or a city the wife? Well, because of the occupants. Who are the occupants? Israel and the church. And so instead of saying, well, the bride has to be Israel, or it has to be the church, I think it's actually both. And I think that's going on here as well. You're going to see the same thing in the New Jerusalem. Because the New Jerusalem is, first of all, the foundation is made up of who? The 12 apostles. We're going to read that text. And then the 12 gates are the 12 tribes of Israel. Huh. So again, the idea is that we enjoy the blessings at the same time. Some want to divide the Jews from the church so much so that even in eternity they have their direction that God wants them to go, and we have the church going in a different direction. I don't see anything that separates us. And everything seems to want to put us all together to be one in Christ. So these verses are kind of interesting. So the idea of this New Jerusalem, there's the idea of it being a triangle or the idea of being a cube. Don't know which is which. I don't know which one it is, because it gives us two dimensions. It doesn't give us enough dimension to be able to figure out the actual shape. So we'll go, but let's go into the text. So Revelation 21, he talks about a number of things, but let's look at verse 9, because Revelation 21, 9 through the end of the chapter and into chapter 22, the last chapter of the Bible, right, is talking about this kingdom and talking about this period of time. And so the debate is this. And again, I think there's a third option. They either fold in and say, well, Revelation 21, 1 through 8 is talking about the eternal state, and then verses 9 through 22:7 talks about the millennial kingdom. They get confused. They think, well, is it talking about things going on in New Jerusalem, or is it talking about things going on the earth in the millennial kingdom? And then the other is, it's eternal state all the way through. And actually, I think the eternal state all the way through makes the most sense. And I take a third option, is that we're confusing. When I think of God, Chuck Mister would say, God lives outside the time zone. He lives outside of space and time, right? So for God, time is like in a box. He can look in the box at any time he wants. He can see the beginning from the end. There's nothing. And if we could transport forward in time or back in time, you're still in the box. You're still not outside the box. He can still see whatever's going on in the domain of time. And so that's a picture of what's going to go on the millennial kingdom on the earth. It's time-based. It's actually 1,000 years. That's time-based, right? It's pretty obvious what's going on the earth is time-based. But those who are believers, and they're in the New Jerusalem, right? Jesus is preparing a place for us. We know the name of it. It's New Jerusalem. For us, that's eternal. When you're in the kingdom, there is no time. If you were to go out of the kingdom, the New Jerusalem, onto the earth, you'd be back in time, but you'd still be a glorified being. So there's two dimensions that are going on there. Outside of time altogether, doesn't mean we're like God, right? But we're no longer, time has no matter and no effect on us in the New Jerusalem, but it does if you're on the earth. But if you're in a glorified body, it doesn't change anything. But time is a factor when you're on the earth. I just want to get that kind of understood, that things are different on the earth than they are in the New Jerusalem, especially concerning time. So, several passages as we go through. So let's go to Revelation 21, look at verse 9. I'm going to start reading this text, the main text here. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked to me, come and I will show you the Lamb's bride, or show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Right? New Jerusalem is the bride. Right? Now he's going back in time now, because he's going back to the plague before the kingdom began. This all ties together to the New Jerusalem. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. So we're on earth, and he's on a high mountain, John is, and he sees this vision of this holy Jerusalem descending down from heaven, right? It's coming down out of heaven towards the earth, it appears, right? Having the glory of God, her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. It was an awesome scene that he's describing. He's trying to describe it the best that he can with the words that he knows at the time. He also had a great, she had a great wall. She is the city, had a great wall, a high wall, and 12 gates, right? And 12 angels at the gates, and the names of them were written on them, which were the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So this kingdom is going to have 12 gates, right? And each of the gates is the name of 12 tribes of Israel. We can have a debate as to which of the 12, because Well, actually, we're going on from there. And then he says, three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, three gates on the west. That's 12. Not too hard to do the math there, right? Verse 14. Now the wall of the city, which had 12 foundations. Okay, so I might come back to this guy. No, I don't want to go that far. I'll get there when I get there. So verse 14 again. Now the wall of the city, which had 12 foundations, and on them were written the name of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So 12 gates, Israel, 12 foundations, the apostles. See, Israel and the church are part of this new Jerusalem, right? Just in those two verses, you see that. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates and its wall. Oh, he's going to give us some numbers, which is cool. The city is laid as a square, right? Laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, its breadth, and its height are equal. Okay, so I guess I did go there. I guess I didn't need to jump down there. I didn't mean to do that. Okay. So the width of it is the same. It's the same up and down. The best we can tell, this seems to be the best dimension for what does it look like. Now, I don't think it's going to look like a cube, but the dimensions of it are the same. He says it's the same all the way around, right? And he measured its walls 140,000 cubits, according to the measure of man, that is of an angel. So he's just describing 140,000 cubits. Right, it's going to be a 1,360 miles when you do the math. Right, 1,360 miles in one direction, 1,360 miles in another, and the same height as it is, how wide it is and how deep it is. Right, so you get the idea. It's pretty big, pretty significant. In fact, I was trying to do it because in verse 16 is where he says 12,000 furlongs, right? Verse 16, which that's where we get the number here when you come through the math. That's where it comes out to. So you get the idea it's going to be very big. You know any city that's big, that big? That's bigger than some states, right? I mean, as far as how big this city is going to be. But this is what's coming down from God out of heaven. This is what's called the bride. It's what's called the Lamb's wife, right? And the foundation is the apostles and the 12 gates or the 12 tribes of Israel. And so it goes on. And I was sitting there thinking about the size of this. I was having a little fun with it. 1,300 miles is pretty big. And if anyone knows anything about the specs of a Bohr cube, it's only 1.8 miles. If you don't know what the Bohr cube is, we lost it. This is Star Trek. anyway, the Bohr, it's 1.8 cube miles, and I know that's imaginary. But the real thing here, the real cube, is going to be huge, much, much larger. In fact, it looks more like this in size. If we were to put it on top of the United States, that's about how big it would be, right? Ooh, look at all those states it would cover, right? So like two-thirds of the country in one big city, trying to put in some human dimension that to talk about it this way. So anyway, and so this is something that appears above the earth at the time of the kingdom. So let me jump back there a couple and look at the earth. So the New Jerusalem, the size perspective, I can't say that's an exact size perspective. Did a little bit of CAD working, and that it appears to be something in that dimension size-wise. Now, when you look at it from space, you're like, what is that sticking out? Well, I don't know, but God's creating it, God's made it, and God's going to provide it. So to put it in perspective, the Earth, the circumference, whether horizontal or vertically, it's not exactly the same. We're not a perfectly round ball, by the way. We're a little bit fatter in the center at the equator than we are vertically, as far as the size. 24,900 versus 24,860 vertically. So it's about 40 miles fatter at the equator than it is going vertically around the Earth. So anyway, that's the ball. That's the sphere, what it looks like. So you get this object, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heavens. And of course, the Earth is 7,900 squares at the widest point across the equator there. And so that's about what the cube is in perspective. And so that's where we are in that context. Okay. So So what we were reading here is that the, let's continue on with the text in verse 12, because he starts giving us the idea of the size. It actually talks about that. So let's go to continue with verse 17. So with the idea, actually I do want to start there, 21:12, because that's, he starts talking about the size of the New Jerusalem, but the fact that there's going to be these. Let me see. I guess it's down there. Verse 17. Verse 18. The construction of its wall. That's what I want to get to. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like pure glass, like clear glass. So it's going to be awesome. It's going to be bright. It's going to be shiny and all that. Then he says, the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper. And some of these words are not words I use all the time for color, so I probably will tear them up as far as what they are. The second is sapphire. The third, chalcedony. The fourth, emerald. The fifth, sardonyx. The sixth, sardis. The seventh, chrysolith. The eighth, beryl. The ninth, topaz. The tenth, chrysoprase. The 11th, jacinth. And the 12th, amethyst. I don't know how to say if I'm even pronouncing half of them right. But they're all stones. They're all precious stones of value. I'm sure a gemist would know what a lot of these are and the value that they have to it. But he says there's 12 foundations. The idea is one and then another one, another. Commonly, I don't know why people have associated certain names of the 12 apostles with the different colors. Nothing here tells me to do that. So I don't know that any one of the 12 apostles should be associated with which one of the 12 foundations. Well, all we know is it's going to be multiple layers of foundation. You know, usually we put a foundation in, we have a layer there, and it's pretty strong, and that's our foundation. This is 12 of them. This is intended to be eternal, secure. The picture is the idea of a perfect building, a perfect city that can't fall apart. So what I tried to do, there's not really good images out there for this. Try to show you that there's different levels of the foundation, one and then another, and the whole thing is ornated with gold and crystal and just beautiful looking. But the idea is these are the 12 apostles, whoever color takes, whatever apostle there is, if they represent a particular color, I don't know. But the idea is going to be 12 of them, and they build on that level, so it's going to look pretty powerful. Then he goes on, the wall, it says in verse 12, the wall is great and high. In fact, it gives us the idea, look at verse 17. Then he measured its wall, 140,000 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is an angel. 140,000 cubits. Well, if you do that, do the math, cubic is 118 inches. You do the math, you come out to it's 216 feet thick. So when you go into... So let's say you're out of the kingdom, out of the New Jerusalem, and you go into one of the gates. It's like a tunnel, I don't know, 216 feet, but I can only imagine it's glorious and bright and awesome. So it's thick. It's an amazing thickness that goes with it. So the wall serves as a reminder that only the redeemed will enter. In fact, that's what he goes on to talk about that, right? The foundation, verse 19. We talked about all that. So, verse 22. But I saw no temple in it. There's no temple in the New Jerusalem. Is there a temple on the earth? Yeah, we talked about that. There will be a temple on the earth when Jesus is on the earth for 1,000 years, right? But there won't be any temple in the New Jerusalem. We won't have a need for it in New Jerusalem. There's no sin there. There's nothing needs to be atoned for or covered or anything like that, right? Then verse 23, and the city had no need of the sun or of the moon, or the moon would not, light would not shine on it. So there's no sun, there's no moon, so whatever is lighting it, we'll talk about that, is something other than, but on the earth, they during the same period of time, they will have the sun, they will have the moon that will light the earth. So again, I want you to get the feel that what's going on the earth and what's going on at the same time in the New Jerusalem hovering above is not the same thing. There's a difference, two dimensions going on at the same time. Verse 23, the city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God illuminated, the Lamb, Jesus, is its light. How does that work? I don't know. Is he bright? This is God. This is a God thing. He's going to make it. He's the light for the entire city, right? They don't need the moon nor the sun. But on the earth, during the same time, they will have a need for the moon and for the sun. And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light. Again, only those who are saved. And the kings of the earth shall bring their glory unto it. So this is where it starts getting people say, well, is he talking about to the Jerusalem on the earth, or is he talking about to the, because he's been talking about the New Jerusalem all throughout here, is where some commentators were very, and say, well, maybe here he's referring to the millennial kingdom. Again, I think both are possible, because but only believers can go into only glorified believers can go into the New Jerusalem, but we, as those with glorified bodies, can come onto the earth and rule and reign with Christ at the same time. It says in verse 25, its gates shall not be shut at all by day. Right? The gates won't be shut. Huh. So anybody can get in, right? Well, let's see. And he said, there will be no night there. Right? He continued. And they shall bring the glory, they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. So that's why they say, it sounds like he's talking about the millennial kingdom, but actually there are going to be nations. There are going to be things like that in the New Jerusalem as well. Verse 27, and there shall be no, by no means, because the gates left open, right? The gates will never shut. But there shall by no means enter into it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Again, absolutely nothing goes into New Jerusalem unless it's perfectly spotless, redeemed, glorified, and holy, right? Nothing can go into the kingdom. That's a God thing. He'll make sure that that's the case, right? So it goes on, in the next verse is chapter 22:1. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. All right, it's just describing this New Jerusalem. It's going to be awesome. In the middle of its streets and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each yielding its fruit every month. So every month it has a different fruit, right? I mean, just kind of, that's not how we think of it. We, in the earthly terms, a tree bears whatever fruit it's designed to do, and that's what it does. It doesn't do more than that, right? This is designed to do more. And then it says, the leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations, and there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and its servants shall serve him. And this is something we look forward to, serving Jesus for eternity. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. Don't know how that works either, but somehow we're identified with Jesus, right? And then verse 25, there shall be no night there. They need no lamp nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light. Again, the idea, and he shall reign forever and ever. So there's a lot of details to it. I don't want to be late on it, but this is kind of a picture of it, another version. Now understand, we're talking about 1,300 miles, so you're not going to be able to see those gates so close together. It's huge, right, in size. It's just the idea that I want you to see 12 foundations and then the high walls, and they're all with the idea of 12 gates there. Gates are always open, you know. You usually shut gates because you're afraid of bad guys coming in on this earth. You don't have to worry about that in New Jerusalem. The gates are always open. That's just the way God wants. The gates are just there for, I don't even know, because we can come and go. So back here, when I was looking at this picture, this would be, you see the gates are part of the wall. This guy's rendition is, this is the 12 foundations. The gates are actually through the foundation. I don't know. You see, nobody knows the details, but I just want you to see the apostles and the 12 tribes of Israel are crucial, because they're all going to be part of this New Jerusalem, the pearly gates. And the last thing I would leave, because I know the zags are coming on soon, right, is the suspended at the beginning of the kingdom, right, that comes down for the 1,000 years. We think it goes up or something during the new heaven and new earth, when it's going to be destroyed by atoms and by fire, completely renewed. And then we think it descends down. So there's some reason to believe that the New Jerusalem, that's out of perspective to the earth in this context, but the New Jerusalem and the earth will still have some relation somewhere into the going into eternity. And so that's what we understand of the millennial kingdom as it relates to New Jerusalem. There's some other details, actually quite a few more, but I think you get the idea. This is outside of time when you're in the New Jerusalem, right? But when you're on the earth, you're inside of time. And so there's that difference in sphere, which God is always outside of time. He knows the beginning from the end. He's not confined to the box of time. He has a different, completely view on everything than we do. Does anyone have any questions? I know there's probably a lot of questions that can be raised in something like this, but I'm just trying to run this through before we go into more verse by verse through the text.
I'm trying to understand that hovering above the earth.
Yeah.
Explain that just a little.
Well, I don't know what exactly that looks like, other than to say that most people, theologians, think that it hovers above Jerusalem. I don't know. Maybe it does, you know, as far as where it's located. And how far from the earth to the New Jerusalem, none of that is described. So it's assumed that it's hovering. It comes down from God out of heaven. So the picture is that it must be coming down to the earth. And there does seem to be some idea of us. We get to be with Jesus forever, but then he's also going to be ruling on the kingdom, on the earth for 1,000 years, and we get to rule and reign with him. So it seems like we have the ability to go from the New Jerusalem to the earth, rule with him, to whatever capacity that is, and I believe even to go back into the New Jerusalem. Again, anything more detailed than that would be way beyond what the text is describing, so I'm trying not to go beyond what the text describes. And yeah,
Mary. In chapter 20, verse 11, and I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. So wouldn't they be gone? Would the earth be gone at that time?
All right, yeah. So the great white throne judgment takes place, we believe, like as you're reading Revelation 20 there, verse 11, would take place, and then there would be the completely renewing of the earth afterwards. So those, what happens at the great white throne judgment before the new heaven and new earth takes place is everyone who's an unbeliever from the beginning of time will be resurrected and will go to this judgment. And so that would be, and again, and I guess that would also include those that rebelled in the kingdom, right? They're going to be part of the unbelievers that will go through the same judgment. And then the earth will be completely renewed. So I think that's the order of events, is the judgment, the great white throne, new heaven, new earth, completely renewed, and then the eternal state, which time is more like God, outside of time altogether. Does that answer the question you were after?
You think the earth will exist forever then?
I think there would be some form of the earth. It seems like Scripture never gives us, it just, why create a new one, a new heaven and a new earth, and it's going to be dissolved by the very atoms if it was going to be destroyed? We made a new heaven and new earth, and then he took it away. I think he must create it with the intent of keeping it. So that's a good question. I think there's going to be a new heaven and new earth because he intends for it to be without any sin and any corruption, any remembrance of what it was like on this earth when there was sin. And I think the earth will continue on, as well as the New Jerusalem, which is eternal. Most of our time will be spent in the New Jerusalem. But why have an earth? I don't know. If we're in glorified bodies and we're in the New Jerusalem, we're probably thinking, why would I want to go back to the earth? I don't know. But it does appear that he'll create it with the intent of keeping it. I guess he's just not dissolving everything. There will be a new heaven and a new earth that will continue on, it appears. Yeah. That's a good question. Why create it? Why renew it if he planned on renewing it and then wiping it out right afterwards? So, any other thoughts, questions? You can always ask questions, of course, afterwards. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Father, thank you for this time, and we just pray that we learn some things, some ideas of things that's going to happen in the future. We're going to be part of it, Father, from the perspective of the New Jerusalem, or ruling and reigning with Christ on the earth, and we'll see the New Jerusalem. We don't know the details at this point other than what you give us, but somehow Jerusalem or Israel and the church and the apostles are all part of this big plan that you have for us, Father. And we just know that you're in charge and you got it all under control. And we trust you now for it all. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.